I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Right before Christmas in 1991, a fire tore through Cameron Todd Willingham's small Texas house, killing his three young daughters. He quickly became a suspect, was convicted of murder, and executed in 2004 after a trial that was riddled with questionable evidence and inconsistent testimony. Our guest, Edward Zwick, has made a film, Trial by Fire, that raises a host of questions about Willingham's guilt. The film stars Laura Dern playing Elizabeth Gilbert, who befriended Willingham in prison and came to believe in his innocence. It also stars Jack O'Connell, who plays Willingham. Here's a scene from Trial by Fire when police question him after the fire.
Can you think of why anyone would want to hurt your family?
No, sir. We had three of the prettiest babies anybody could have asked for. Off and on, we'd fight and break up for a while, but it was always the babies that brought us back together. Neither of us could have lived without them kids. Sometimes I wish Amber had never woke me up.
Now, Todd, you've been in trouble before.
Yes, sir.
A couple of those times when we asked you what happened, you didn't exactly tell the truth, isn't that so?
No, sir.
But you're telling the truth now.
Yes, sir.
Trial by Fire opens on May 17th. Edward Zwick is an award-winning filmmaker, producer, and screenwriter who has directed many movies, including Glory, The Last Samurai, Defiance, Legends of the Fall, Blood Diamonds. He produced Shakespeare in Love, for which he got an Academy Award. He was nominated for an Oscar for Traffic, and he co-created 30-something. And he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Edward Zwick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Did Texas execute an innocent man?
Yes, they did. It's, really regarded by many as the signal case against the death penalty. And it's only been revealed to be more and more of an abomination.
And we're talking about questionable evidence, arson investigators who seem to believe that...
The case was a catalog of everything that's wrong with the criminal justice system. It wasn't just junk science, which led the charge, but also it was... the withholding of exculpatory evidence, the use of jailhouse snitches in exchange for reduced sentences, and the lack of means to afford a proper defense. In fact, very little defense. The jury was out for 45 minutes.
The Texas Forensic Science Commission basically, said that the evidence, the arson evidence, just did not hold up.
Well, that's what they said 10 years later. Right. After his execution, they formed a commission, and the commission was about to issue a report to that effect, and Governor Perry dissolved the commission before it could issue its report.
So is this your argument against the death penalty?
Yeah, there's a very famous quote by Justice Scalia that says, should it ever be revealed that an innocent man was put to death, that his name would be shouted from the rooftops. I think this is that shout.
And yet people, I would say outside of Texas, probably have never heard of Cameron Todd Willingham.
That's right. Although, I mean, he's become a bit of an avatar to something. The Innocence Project has taken on the case, and I think will eventually he'll be exonerated eventually should this kind of pressure continue.
One of the prisoners who's on death row, they're talking about capital punishment, and he says, "If you ain't got the capital, you get the punishment."
Yeah, Brian Stevenson, who's a wonderful voice for reform, once said that it's better to be rich and guilty than be poor and innocent.
And Willingham himself claimed from the beginning until his execution that he was an innocent man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's also a difficult man, we should say. We're talking domestic violence, drinking, clearly has a temper, doesn't really have a job when we meet him. He's got Satanist tattoos and posters.
Yeah.
I mean, he's complicated and not particularly likable when we first meet him.
Yeah, I mean, I would say disreputable and worse. And I think that actually makes the story all the more significant because all those things are true, yet not deserving of his fate. I think society has a tendency to pick out the other and to scapegoat that person when something inexplicable happens. I think this is a time in which demonization is a theme in our culture, and I think he was a victim of just that.
And it was pretty clear from, and I've read about it, and I saw some documentaries about it and saw your film as well, is that the police and others, they knew this guy because he had been arrested before. They just thought he was guilty from the get-go.
Yeah, and that's often, you know, the case in which they've anointed someone and then they prove that case. I mean, you know, look, journalists are guilty of that as well. They have a point to make and they look to make that point as opposed to... the difference was that David Grann, who wrote the article in The New Yorker, went down to Texas without any preconceptions. He had no notion that that was going to be the story that he would write. And you watch as it unfolds for him. And for me, what was really interesting in the article and then what led me to shape the film was that you look at this case, as does the jury, as do the people of Corsicana, and initially you condemn him. And therefore you become complicit. And your participation in the movie is more active, I think, because as it begins to unfold, you realize that you are as responsible.
Did you then have access to court transcripts? I have David Grann's article right here. I know that was the basis for this film in many ways, but also the letters that he wrote from prison.
Yeah, Elizabeth Gilbert, who is, you'll tell this story, I'm sure, soon about this woman who took on his case almost randomly. But she gave us all of her correspondence with Todd, her letters and Todd's. We had all of the transcripts. We spoke to many of the lawyers who have since tried to intervene. Right. And so, yeah, we had great access.
You cast Jack O'Connell, who I have to say is British, but he does have a Texas accent in this film. You cast him to play Todd, and I kept looking at him saying, I know this face. Mm-hmm. And then I remember, yes, Godless.
That's right. Yeah, he did that very well, actually. Look, if he were sitting here now and we're speaking, he's from Derby. It's a very difficult accent to even understand, and yet he transforms utterly with great work. He worked with a dialect coach who's probably the dean of that, a man named Tim Monick. He worked with me with Leonardo DiCaprio in Blood Diamond and created that wonderful accent that Leo did. But the thing about Jack is his willingness to embrace those dark qualities that you refer to. Because had we chosen, not chosen, but had it been a story about a man who was utterly Job-like and innocent, I think it could have bordered into sentimentality. Mm-hmm. And this plays against that, I think.
You also have Emily Mead. She plays his wife, Stacy. And again, I was looking at her, saying, yeah. I know I've
Who is
seen
that?
This face
Who is
before.
That person?
And it was The Deuce is where I remember seeing her.
Yeah, she's great. And, you know, she disappears into that part and all the others.
So what was it about these two actors then that you wanted to play such pivotal roles?
Well, you know, that's a very ineffable choice. You just feel something and it feels right. I think I like the fact that they didn't carry with them any baggage of persona of other parts that you would recognize, and you would really believe the authenticity of who they were.
Well, let me play another scene from this film, Trial by Fire. And this is Todd Willingham's wife, Stacy, again played by Emily Mead. And she's on the stand at her husband's trial being questioned about his character and whether he beat her. And this is what she says.
You don't understand, Todd. He's not like that. Todd would never do anything to hurt those babies. He loved those babies with all his heart. He treated those babies better than anybody else did. He would feed them and change their diapers, and he potty trained them, and you are not listening. Everybody's in here making up lies. No one's paying attention to the facts. No one's telling the f***ing truth.
The witnesses
excuse. No one's telling the truth or listening to anything we're saying.
Young lady.
When do we get a chance to say the truth?
You will step down.
I'm sorry.
Is that from the trial?
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing about the trial is what came out is that Stacy herself had been, her mother had been killed by her father. So she came from an environment of great complexity and pain. And Stacy, having staunchly defended Todd, then later turned against him for reasons that were, I think, inexplicable and yet makes sense.
I mean, it is in some ways such a human story because you've got people who struggle with each other and you see their relationship. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to watch because there's violence actually on both sides. Mm-hmm. And yet there's this interesting chemistry between the two of them.
There is. Well, I mean, I thought about, you know, Johnny and June and some relationships that are fighting and I'll save that word for, you know, for a beep. But, you know, I think what's interesting in the movie is that it is as interesting to me as it is this depiction of a set of relationships as it is about some institutional failure. Mm-hmm. And the relationship between Todd and Elizabeth is as beautiful and as soulful as anything. And it's a very interesting juxtaposition against the story. It gives the movie, I think, its life and its beating heart, which it needs, because otherwise it would be too difficult to watch.
And we should say that Laura Dern plays Elizabeth mm-hmm. Gilbert, and they begin as pen pals, mm-hmm. and then she visits him, and it's the beginning of this relationship, but also her belief that he's an innocent man.
Yeah, she's not a lawyer or anything of the sort. She does something almost randomly. She's at a moment in her life that's a little bit at sea, and agrees to write a letter, and gets this letter back, and it strikes something in her. They begin a correspondence that becomes this relationship as she begins to visit him. And those visits are at the heart of the movie.
Well, and I love in the visits, it seems that there's a camera on his face and a camera on her face. And you watch them mm-hmm. looking at each other. And the first time they meet, it's almost like an awkward blind date or something. Like, what do you say to someone who's on death row?
Well, you know, I did something very deliberately, which is to say I worked with Laura independently. She met Elizabeth, worked with her. We went to prisons. We talked about the case. I also worked with Jack, and we shot his scenes separately. I deliberately kept them apart.
Oh, interesting.
And it wasn't until we shot those scenes that I put them opposite each other, so it would have that same quality of discomfort and growth into the various things as we shot them in sequence.
And we should, it sounds like Elizabeth Gilbert, how involved was she in the making of the film?
Very. She was exceedingly generous. Her story is very painful as well.
Oh, yeah.
But she was a great help in terms of opening a window into Todd, because she knew him and then had his letters. But also, she was great for Laura, and Laura great for her, because, you know, as a writer, you try to put yourself inside someone's experience to the best of your ability. But sometimes you make mistakes which are, you know, forgivable, because they come out of a kind of earnestness. And the temptation to describe Elizabeth as this a little bit more beatific figure, once Laura got to know her and saw her humor and her self-mockery, she came more to life. And that's what happens when you work with a great actress, because she makes you better, not just in her work, but in her influence over yours.
That's Edward Zwick, our guest on Radio Times today. We're talking about his new film. It opens on May 17th, and it's called Trial by Fire, based on an execution that happened in Texas a number of years ago. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Edward Zwick. He's a filmmaker, producer, screenwriter, and he's got a new film that opens on May 17th called Trial by Fire. Let me play one more scene from this new film. And again, this is Elizabeth Gilbert, played by Laura Dern. She has gotten involved in this case of Todd Willingham, believing that he's innocent. It begins with a pen pal relationship, and this is a letter that Todd then sends to her at the start of their relationship.
Death row inmates aren't allowed to associate with the general population. We have no contact at all with the outside. No one in the whole world knows I exist. I feel like I am slowly being erased. Please excuse my writing. I'm learning to express myself better. I've added your name to my visitors list in case you decide to come. Meantime, I hope your life turns forever forward. Yours, Cameron Todd Willingham.
How many letters between the two of them? I mean, she kept them, right?
Oh, yeah. I have never actually counted. There were many, and they were over years.
And what we hear, I mean, as I listen to the letters and their conversation, I mean, it does feel as if he becomes a better person in prison.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the ironies. This is someone who'd never really been exposed to that kind of attention and books and time to reflect and anything like that. And it's even an argument for a kind of the possibility of the change from a certain kind of toxic masculinity to a real soulfulness.
You do. I hope this isn't giving too much away. I mean, it's based on a true story. Mm-hmm. He is executed in 2004. Mm-hmm. The camera does not turn away from his execution.
Well,
and we don't get to see executions in this country.
No, I think I felt that if one indeed condemned him, as the audience tends to in the beginning, I think they're then obliged to see all of it. And it's obviously a very powerful scene, and one that we were all dreading, but there is in it something oddly transcendent, because of what has happened with them and what it leads to.
It's interesting that we were talking about this before going on the air, that there is this interest, even almost obsessive interest, in true crime stories these days.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder about that. I mean, I wonder if it was just finally we'd exhausted the old tropes of crime and punishment like Law and Order, or I wonder if there's some new burgeoning interest, particularly among younger people, in injustice. You know, we have an unpunished predator at the top of the system right now. There's an awareness of our impotence to change certain things as they're happening around us. And I know that there are the podcasts like Serial and Making of a Murder, and there's one called My Favorite Murder. They're very very popular.
I've heard of that. Yep.
19 million hits a month, I think. You know, so I think there is, and maybe even there's some quest or desire for authenticity, unless it's just perverse. Mm-hmm. Or fascination, I don't know.
Or the sort of prurience, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it's probably got a piece of that in there.
You bet, you bet.
Let's talk a little bit about how you started in the filmmaking world. And I read it began in high school, not filmmaking, but interest in acting and theater.
Yeah, I was that theater kid.
You were.
I couldn't stop. And I think in some way my whole career has been an attempt to recapitulate those feelings, the passion and the intensity of that.
Those high school dramas?
Yep, you bet.
Which ones?
Oh, please. There were the predictable ones and less predictable. I went to a high school that actually was very enlightened in its system, but we also did, you know, we did musicals. But I got to do a production of The Visit by Durenmaat.
In high school?
In high school.
Wow.
We did The Playboy of the Western World by John Millington Singh. So it was a little more evolved, and it was actually a very interesting moment. It was in the 70s, and it was in the suburbs of Chicago, and many of the student teachers who came were avoiding the draft by, you know, keeping their deferments in graduate school. And there was a couple of men, one in particular, a guy named Mark Lamus, who was just a student teacher when I was maybe a junior or senior, right, who then went on to form the Hartford Rep Company and was a wonderful influence. And I was blessed with those kind of, you know, teachers.
Did you act in some of these plays? You have a funny look on your face.
God, it was
a very innocent question.
Enough to know that I never would again.
Really?
Yeah.
But you recognize it in other people, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the thing that kept me from being any good at all was that I had some real interest in the whole story and the stagecraft and the storytelling, and I didn't have the self-absorption that was enough to be so internal as to shut everything else out.
I was trying to think, so what is an Edward Zwick film? I mean, I think we know, like, we would recognize a Woody Allen film or a Scorsese film. I mean, you just feel like, almost from the opening credits, it's like, you know what you are going to see, even though it's obviously a different movie every time. But I don't think that applies to you so much.
Well, it might have to do with having been first trained in the repertory theater, doing Sam Shepard one night and Molière the next, and it might have to do with a certain intellectual promiscuity that I'm interested in any number of subjects and forms, and I remember once reading a quote from Satchel Paige that says, always stay a moving target.
Oh, And you like that?
I do. Yeah.
So we, I also like we can't categorize
no,
you, right?
I also like being a little bit scared.
Oh.
I like putting myself in situations that where I really have to pay attention and I don't have some reliable habits to fall back on.
And being scared makes you more creative, more,
yeah,
take,
I think you
more
reach,
willing to take a risk.
Yeah, I think you explore different places inside and you discover things about yourself. And after a certain amount of times as a professional, I mean, I think about what you do for a living. You, mm-hmm. you do your homework every day and confront a new subject that you didn't know anything about. And it allows you to be a little bit of a perpetual student. And that keeps me alive.
Yeah. I do think, though, you said relationship several times
yes.
during our conversation. And that, I mean, if there is something that seems to interest you over
Absolutely.
These many years.
And even in the context of the broadest canvas, and that could be the Gulf War or it could be the war on drugs or it could be terrorism, the relationships between the people are at the center. And that is what interests me the most. And that's a link between the TV I've done and the movies that right. I've done because – In a larger canvas, it creates this edifice on which the relationships can rest. It also gives you a legitimate cause to have this drama for nothing, and the intensity doesn't seem forced as it does sometimes in domestic drama. It just is there.
Let me play. There, so many films. I picked two.
Okay.
We could have picked many more, but I wanted to play Glory, a scene from Glory. This is the story of the 54th Regiment of the Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry, one of the first all-black regiments in the Union Army. Stars Matthew Broderick. He plays Colonel Robert Shaw. Denzel Washington as Private Silas Tripp. He's a fugitive slave. And in this scene, Tripp, played by Denzel Washington, watches as Corporal Thomas Searles, played by Andre Brower, straightens his uniform as he looks in a mirror.
Yeah, button up that collar. Suck in that gut. Tuck in them big black lips. Lighten your skin. Shrink up that nose.
I don't have to listen to this.
Where you going, boy?
Let me buy.
Let you buy? Let you buy. Let me tell you something, boy. You can march like the white man. You can talk like him. You can learn his songs. You can even wear his suits. But you ain't never gonna be nothing to him but an ugly-ass chimp in a blue suit.
A scene from Glory. I love this film, I have to say. And that, of course, is Denzel Washington, Morgan Freeman, Andre Brower. This was 30 years ago.
Yeah, I'm aware. The funny thing is they're actually going to re-release it in theaters this summer.
They
did a 4K restoration, and I guess the TCM is going to put it in theaters in 600 theaters for a couple of days this summer.
Did you have anything to do with that?
Nope.
What? You have worked with Denzel Washington several times, The Siege, Courage Under Fire.
Yep. And we remain good friends. This was the first time, though, on that movie that we worked together.
Was this the beginning of his career? This is 19...
Very early. I think,
89.
Yeah, he had done St. Elsewhere, and I think he'd done Soldier's Story. I think that was about all.
What do you look for? I mean, we've been talking about some of the actors
sure.
that you have worked with. Was there something... I mean, he's such a great actor.
Yeah.
What can I say?
You know,
silly question.
Yeah, well, you know, there is that fascination... with what is happening inside. And it's been my experience that those movie stars have so much going on that they don't reveal, and yet the camera intuits it and sees it inside. They are pretty much all geniuses of a particular kind, not traditional, not necessarily academic, but so such antic minds and such fascinating processes that you can't look away, and then they let you in every now and then, and you're grateful.
Is it the camera or is it the director, meaning you?
You know, I think, look, you, the director tries to see things. I mean, I've always liked to think of casting movie stars as actors rather than for their persona. I also think that it's a little bit like the difference between driving a big truck with no power steering or driving a Ferrari. Not that I've done a lot of either, but you know, you have to crank a truck around and, you know, get it to turn. And with a Ferrari, if you just touch the wheel, it goes screaming around a corner. And those brilliant actors, you just really create an environment in which they can be and which they are comfortable, and things around them are authentic, which is to say the words are right. the staging is right, the props are right, the lighting is right, and they then exist within it and then create within it and feel safe and free and protected to just go. And you're pretty smart if you just stay the heck out of their way.
Well, I was wondering, under those circumstances, where are you? Are you quietly observing in the corner?
No, I mean, you're looking through the camera because you want to see what the camera sees. And, you know, the camera is this technological, you know, it's a device. It sees what's there. It's like a little Buddha. It doesn't have your expectations and your anxieties, and it's clinical. And the hardest thing is to really see what it is seeing.
Oh, you have to learn that, don't you?
Yeah, it takes a while. You have to really divest yourself of a lot of your own anxieties and try to be present and honest.
Well, as I said, there were many films we could have chosen, but I did choose Defiance.
Okay.
And I don't know if you agree with this or not. Someone said, well, this is like Glory for Jews. I don't know if that fits your...
That's really funny.
your vision of this particular film. But this is a scene from your film, Defiance, based on the true story of Jewish partisans who sheltered Jews in a forest in Belarus and fought off the Nazis. Daniel Craig plays Tuvia Bielski, and in this scene is speaking to a frightened group of survivors.
Friends, this is the happiest day of my life, to see you here, safely amongst us. But there are a few things you must learn about living here. When you are rested and settled, you will be assigned work duties. Everyone will work. There are no exceptions. We will help supply our Russian partisan comrades. We will mend clothes. We will repair weapons. Women will learn to shoot, and they will fight alongside men. Pregnancies are forbidden. We cannot accommodate an infant's needs here. Today, we will start rebuilding the lives you have all lost. This is the one place in all of Belarus where a Jew can be free. We welcome you into our community.
And as, again, a scene from Defiance. You wrote something in the New York Times, Shadows of Valiant Ancestors. You said, my grandfather, Itzki, was a tough Jew. I'm named after him. My Hebrew name is Yitzhak. In the 20s, Chicago, his five brothers, the uncles as they were known, Dovey, Fat, Zeus, Zell, and Jules, were, quote, betting commissioners, i.e. bookies for the Capone mob. As a boy, I secretly relished my family's unsavory past.
Yeah. I think in some sense, the closest I could get was to be a film director, but that involves a certain amount of toughness and a certain amount of will and a certain amount of theatricality.
And these guys were, so they were your...
They're my father's uncles.
Oh, father's uncles.
My father's uncles, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And my father actually recalled as a very young boy having seen Capone. When he came out of prison, he was very, very old and very sick, but what he felt when he saw him.
This was an article about why you wanted to make Defiance.
Uh-huh.
I mean, basically saying, someone said, no, this is a story of Jewish heroes like the Maccabees, only better.
Yeah, I mean, look, it is the most remarkable story, and obviously it is in line with something I do believe, which is to say, if the facts conform to dramatic truth, then it's a story you can make a movie of. But I wasn't about to invent a story. It has to be remarkable in its own renown. It has to be intrinsically, complete. And this was the most remarkable story. And it was really brought home to me when we were there in Belarus, freezing our asses off and wearing down and Gore-Tex and... Sorel boots and whatever, and realize that these people did this for three Russian winters with wet leather clothes and newspaper stuffed in their shoes. And you realize this was one of the truly remarkable moments in human history.
We're almost out of time here. Are there movies that you keep going back to that you have loved your whole life?
Of other people.
Of
course, constantly. I mean, gosh, there are so many. I mean, it's... you know, The Seven Samurai is a teaching course in film direction. Any movie by Renoir is this window into the human condition. There are people, there are American directors who were, you know, idols to me. And some, Sidney Pollack was a kind of mentor to me, and his movies, you know, really were important to me. And, oh gosh, it's too many. I could go on. This would be the next hour.
You also have a long-standing partnership with Marshall Herskovitz.
A Philadelphia native.
I was going to say a Philadelphia native. See, everything does have something to do with Philadelphia. Without him, can you imagine what your career would be?
No, we met our first day in film school. I mean, we have been each other's, obviously, best friends, first brothers, scourges, teachers. You know, what we discovered very early is there was no continuing education and few people that would continue to tell you the truth after you begin to do well. And we have been that for each other, too, a kind of litmus or
I mean, and to have someone to tell you the truth.
It's worth everything.
It's worth everything. Well, Edward Zwick, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And we've been talking about making movies. He's got a new one, Trial by Fire, and it opens on May 17th. Closing out with some music from Glory, the soundtrack, after Antietam, composed and conducted by James Horner, performed by the Boys Choir of Harlem. After this short break, we'll be talking about organizing in the gig economy. Stay with us. We'll be right back.